So may I introduce Professor Danny Dorling. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that introduction and thank you for coming. I will talk for about 40 minutes, 50 minutes if I'm badly behaved, but there will be a chance to question me on what I have to say. It's also very nice to be in the Huxley Lecture Theatre. My favourite Huxley is Aldous. If any of you are my age, Brave New World was what you had to read when you were 15. Aldous was the Huxley born with a squint, who was somewhat suspicious of the other members of his family who believed that superior individuals would rise to the top quite so much. And it is of relevance to what I've got to say this evening. We are in what is now the most unequal country in Europe. I have a lot of graphs and maps and tables to show you, but I don't have one of these statistics because I think they're so well known now. He's worrying about the echo. Yeah. Come round. Our best off 1% take about 14-15% of all income a year in this country. In other countries such as Switzerland, they take half as much, in Netherlands just 7%. You have to go all the way across the Atlantic to find a more unequal country than ours. The best off 10% in this country take 28% of all income. This is the highest proportion of the best off 10% in any European country. Now, this means a lot to me because I am a strange and weird individual who liked maths when I was young. But one problem about talking about inequalities and 10% taking 28% and 1% taking 14% is it washes over you. But it really is very unusual. If you look again at Switzerland, where they have bankers and the banking sector and a divided society, but the best off 1% take half as much and the best off 10% take much less, they can do things such as spend twice as much on their health services per head than we do. And the poorest tenth of people are living on almost three times as much as our poorest tenth. The poorest 20% in this country are the poorest in Western Europe. But we're used to this. This is what we have lived in for some time. If you're younger than me, this is what you grew up in. The blurb there says how I'm going to begin to look at this. I'm going to look first of all at the things that matter most to people in life, and then I'm going to tell you a series of opinions of what I think we could do to make it better and show you some fairly depressing slides. But I'm trying very hard not to be too depressing, because I don't think we will actually become the most unequal country in the rich world. I think things are on the beginnings of a turn. If any of you are finding this is beginning to get boring and you happen to have an iPad or a laptop in front of you.
Can we just turn you up a little bit so the people at the back of the
Okay. We've gone up again.
That's not my steam engine.
That's probably enough for we'll echo again.
Okay.
I'll try and talk louder. Is that okay for the back? Yes, great. Okay, type in that web address if you want to see these maps. I've zoomed in on Brighton just for you, but you can look at any town and city in the country. You can look at where you were born or where you might think of moving to retire. The dark red areas are in the poorest tenth in the country by the official deprivation index, which is now a very clever deprivation index because it's based on individual data on people's benefit claims. And the dark green areas are in the richest tenth. And you'll see that this is a divided city, but all our cities are divided. Often people could compete to claim that their city is the most divided in England, which it seems like a strange acolyte to have. I thought when I was growing up in Oxford I was living in the most divided city, and then I moved to Newcastle and I was told it's very divided. Later on I was in Leeds and somebody said, we've got the street with the biggest social gradient, and it's taken me some large amount of migration to realise the slope is the same in all our cities. It's quite remarkable. And if you go to other European countries, you find the slope is much less steep. The best off have less. They actually have nicer houses. They have bigger houses, they have happier lives, but they have less money in cash terms. And the poor are far better off than we. So the idea of a fairer city is a city in future which doesn't look as starkly divided as this. Because when you have these huge differences, the best off tenth getting every year well over 10 times more than the worst off tenth, people begin to move away from each other. They move physically away from each other. They're willing to pay hundreds of thousands of pounds more for a house that's a mile away from an area they're trying to avoid. They try to get their children into a school so they don't have to mix with other children. This is not normal on much of the continent. The continent, for instance, has hardly any private education sector. It still has educational divisions, but private, and especially public, which of course we mean but very, very private education, of which you've got at least one school here. I was in Winchester earlier this week, where I showed these slides to the boys in Winchester. £36,000 a year to be in Winchester. This kind of thing doesn't happen elsewhere, but one interesting thing about us is that we've got used to it. Now here's a way of looking at things differently. A few years ago with my colleague Demetrius Ballas, we looked at a big household survey of all the people living in the UK, and we looked at two questions that household survey asked. So I just ask you, I'm not going to get anybody to reveal their answers, but just have a think about how you would respond to these two questions. The first question was asked at the very end of the survey, and the question was, state in your own words, what in the last year has happened to you or your family which has stood out as important. And you can list up to four things. So have a little think and see what you would have said in the last 12 months has happened to you or your family which has been of importance. Don't feel bad if you don't have anything, by the way. The majority of people didn't have anything. The second question we looked at was asked in a very different part of the survey. It's a very English question. The wording is very, very English. So it is, have you recently been feeling reasonably happy, all things considered? You're only allowed three answers. You can either say, no, I generally have been feeling less than reasonably happy. Two, I felt the same as usual. And three, actually, I've been feeling more than reasonably happy. So all think of a number between one and three. We're not going to use these numbers. It's just for your personal use. Because I'm going to show you how the first events predict the second. That there's no point talking about fairness, I think. It's a very academic point, but there's not much practical point talking about fairness if the kind of fairness you're talking about isn't likely to make people happier. You know, you can have an incredibly fair society in which you're all pretty miserable, which would happen, there are ways of conceiving it. The cash point stopped working for a month. That's what you'll get. And we'd all be pretty equal. Interestingly, if you go to where that happened, which is Greece, and in particular if you go to the island where my friend Demetrius, who co-authored this paper with me, lives at the moment, where he didn't get his paycheck for 3 months, his €800, didn't get to come out of the cash point, they weren't that unhappy. They were unhappy when it began, when the crisis began, but they stopped being unhappy in Mytilene on Lesbos when people started turning up every day in rubber dinghies with absolutely nothing. And then suddenly, the fact that you're not being paid and your country's in a complete chaos doesn't look quite so bad compared to middle-class people turning up with a mobile phone, with all their documents on it scanned, but with no charger. So it's things can and do change. But this is about normality. So here's the results of this little test. And the minute you see them, I think they appear to be obvious. But what makes people happy? What has the biggest effects on happiness and sadness? Isn't things like getting more money or less money. It's actually very down-to-earth things. And perhaps things that you maybe appreciate more when you get older. The worst thing that can happen to you individually may have happened, well, will have happened to people in this lecture theatre, roughly about 10% of you, is that your relationship will have ended in the last year. You'll have got divorced or split up from your long-term boyfriend or girlfriend. And odds on, you chose the number that is less than reasonably happy. Our relationships really matter to us. And one way in which I look at these results, apologies for the incredibly incomprehensible title of the table. That's the kind of thing you have to put if you're going to get your academic work published in an academic paper. And the reason why I wrote the book, which I'll show you in a minute, this is based on this, of course, nobody reads it if you do that. But anyway, for the social scientists in the room, that's what we did. We worried about people's age squared, which means you worry about them becoming really old. The worst thing that can happen to you is your relationship ending. And then the second worst thing is that one of your parents dies. Now, this is interesting because, in a way, hopefully, almost all of us will experience our parents dying, because the only way you can not experience your parents dying is if you die before them. You know, it's going to happen to all of us, or already happened to many of you. But despite the fact it's entirely predictable, we deal with it, or deal with death in such a way in this country, that the death of our parents results in our unhappiness. The health of our parents results in our unhappiness. The death of somebody else has a big effect on us. And then losing your job. And then your own health. And then somebody else in your family dying. Which death's relatively rare. So it's quite incredible these came up. The health of a partner, the health of a child, health of another. And below all of that, if you report something about your child's education, odds on it's associated with less happiness. So don't feel bad. If one of the four things that happened to you in the last 12 months involved a child's education, it might have involved didn't do very well at their exams, was suspended from school. That's actually odds on. For parents, education is associated with less happiness. I'll show you in a minute. For children and students, it's generally associated with happiness. So things are better. But this is the depressing side of life. The key measure for this is that health matters more than everything else. Remember, this is all about other people's, largely other people's health. And then if you want a fair society, you do have to ask, why are we choosing to fund our health service at half the rate they choose to fund it in Switzerland? At about 50%, 49% less than they fund it in Germany, 27% less than they fund it in France. In fact, less per head than they fund their health service in any country apart from Greece after the crisis, not before, and Italy after the crisis. We have a brilliantly efficient National Health Service. Partly because it's brilliantly efficient, we have cut and cut in real terms its funding compared to what other countries choose to spend on. So I would say the very first thing you need to do if you want a fairer society or city is to not fund health and social services as lowly as we do. Let's get some more pleasant things up. You have to start from the bottom here. These are the things associated with more happiness in life. Starting a relationship. In a way, all those deaths are about the end of a relationship. And so starting a relationship is likely to make you happy. More than ending, because when you start a relationship, presumably both of you are happy. Whereas when you end it, one person maybe. It's not a reason to start lots of them, but anyway. Then getting a job. Not getting rich, but getting a job does make people happier, because unemployment really has a bad effect on you. Being able to buy a house causes great happiness. It's not becoming wealthy, it's the feeling of security of getting a massive debt so that you can't be evicted. And then becoming pregnant or becoming a parent. I love these surveys. The thing that tickled me most in this survey was that women are three times more likely to report having become a mother than men are. To report as one of four things that happened of significance to them in a year. Men, two times out of three, forget. But in general, becoming a parent helps. Grandparents are very good at remembering. As I said, your own education. If you report something about education to do with you, it tends to be associated with success and happiness. With your parents, it's the other way around. Leisure is generally good. Changing jobs is generally good. Your child starting a relationship or getting married, that tends to make people happier. A pregnancy and birth in the family, somebody else's pregnancy birth, in fact, any birth is good. This is the births. I should say for the parents who are sceptical in the room, being a parent isn't associated with greater happiness. It comes fairly shortly after the birth and carries on for some time. And then if we go up, getting a car, so there's a bit of material gain. If you look at leisure or holiday and you look across at numbers, again, one sort of take-home message from this before I move on to more things. There isn't much net gain from a family holiday. So don't feel bad if the family holiday wasn't good. They don't. Although I can make you feel a bit guilty. Last year we have household below average income statistics which look at what happens to the poorest fifth, the next fifth, the middle fifth of children, the almost top fifth and the top fifth of children. And one of the many things that are studied until the government cuts this series, which they're planning to, along with half of all the rest of our social stats. One of the things household below average income reveals is that last year almost half our children in Britain did not have a summer holiday, other than possibly staying with granny, staying with a relative or a friend. Half children, because their parents said they couldn't afford it. Now, they didn't say that when they went back to school. When you go back to school in September 2015, you make a holiday up, don't you? But we are a country in which almost half of our children, a third of children are officially poor, half have parents who couldn't afford a holiday. And one instant reaction in Britain you get is, well, why didn't they take out the Haven holiday offer in the Sun newspaper? But the reason partly why is that for the third of people living in poverty, you can't save £10 a month. So even a very cheap offer. And there's more associates. You've got to get to the caravan. You know, there's other things you have to do. I'm going to make it positive, I haven't gone about it, but the thing that really annoys me about these statistics is when you look at the best off fifth of our children, which of course includes me and my children, and you're looking at six holidays on average. And a fairer city, I think, would be a city in which at least every child gets to go on holiday once a year. And if that has to be at the expense of a few children not having multiple holidays, I really don't think that's terrible, particularly given that the family holidays those privileged children go on are actually unlikely to make them happy and could easily end up with a ski accident. Anyway, here's the plug for the book. All of this is in the book, so I will zoom forward much more quickly now. And the book begins with that study and then uses this as an excuse to talk about health, to talk about education, to talk about relationships and to say, what could we do to make things better about the things that appear to matter most to people. So on housing, this may be the most complicated graph I've got to show. It goes from 1983 to 2012. You've got age down the side, down to age 90. That band in the middle is the band of people who were able to get a mortgage. And eventually, in most cases in the past, they own their home. Don't fool yourself to think that if you've just managed to get a mortgage in 25 years, you're going to own your home nowadays. You've got to make 25 times 12 payments. You've got to stay together with the person you're paying the mortgage with. You've got to not become ill. You've not got to not be sacked. Mortgages are a very less safe bet than they used to be. But anyway, they're not even an option for the under 35s anymore in a place like this and a place like Brighton. There's nothing wrong with having a society in which half the people rent. That is Switzerland, that is Germany. But there is something very wrong in having a society in which we're heading back towards 90% renting, if you take current trends forward, private renting, in which you can be evicted with 2 months' notice. It is not that easy to bring up children, particularly, say, in London, where the majority of children who are poor in London are now suddenly in the private rented sector, on average being moved every 3 years, so having to move schools. It is just silly, and it's happened quite quickly, and it is not needed. One very long quote from the book that I'll let you read. The book starts off with about 12 social scientists, and particularly economists, although Benjamin isn't one, and about recent studies by these economists about what appears to make people happier. And this isn't about superficial happiness. This is not asking you on a scale of 1 to 10, how happy are you? If we were to do that, on average, because this is England, you would say 7. In countries with a higher level of numeracy than we have, they tend to say 5. So we say that they're less happy. But they've just got a better idea of averages on a scale from 0 to 10. If you go to the US, you're heading towards 8, but they're less numerate. This is about happiness when you measure questions such as, do you look forward to the future? Do you have trouble sleeping at night? The kind of questions, if any of your GPs have ever asked you these questions and seen whether you don't score well on 6 out of 12 of them, they're testing you for anxiety and depression. So it's that kind of level of happiness. It correlates very highly with the amount of Prozac being bought and the equivalent antidepressant drugs. 1 in 10 people in Scotland are getting a daily dose of antidepressants now. I don't have the figures for England. We know they've been rising. You have to go all the way to America, particularly Los Angeles, to find higher levels. And interestingly, you have to go to Beverly Hills to find the highest. So the best of are not necessarily that high. And if you travel towards Scandinavia or Denmark or the Netherlands or Germany or France or even Japan if you want somewhere outside of Europe, and you look at the World Health Organization clinical surveys of anxiety and depression, you find levels that are half or a third of our levels. So we worry about our children's mental health and self-harming and increasing signs that this is getting worse. What we do not know is this is so much better in countries where there is less inequality. And there are very simple reasons why it's better, because if you're a child growing up in a more equal country, all the pressure's less, if not off. You can do well at exams if you want to, but you won't be paid that much more. So if you grow up in Switzerland and you decide that you want to be a nurse, or even be somebody who cleans other people's houses, you can choose to do that because they have to pay their cleaners, in some cases, £30 an hour in Switzerland. So you can live off it. If you go to Japan, you can actually live as a man holding a beacon up and letting children cross the road, because in Japan they value children's lives so highly that they think they ought to pay the person who makes sure the children are safe crossing the roads. I know it's a mad idea, we should just let our children die. As we do in this country. I'll give you one. I'm going to make it fun. But what do you want? And I'm a geographer. This is my excuse for doing these geographical comparisons. There was a man who was caught in Switzerland speeding with his Ferrari at 85 miles an hour, who went through a village 3 times. They fined him €185,000.
Wow.
Yeah, because the speeding fines in Switzerland are proportional to income. So they use his income, €185,000. You might think that's strange. In Finland, the highest fine I've seen was about £80,000 equivalent quite recently. But the best fine was and it didn't hit anybody. Just a speeding fine. A footballer in Germany, I think one of our footballers, has recently, last year, paid €500,000 fine for driving under the influence of drugs and alcohol. Didn't hit anybody. The fines are proportional to income. For a very brief period, we actually had fines slightly proportional to income in this country. The magistrates refused to give them out because they thought it wasn't fair. The biggest killer of people in this country between the age of 5 and 25 is being hit by a car. But we have a very, very different mindset to other countries. And we spend in very, very different ways. This graph comes from the radical socialist organisation, International Monetary Fund. I was accused down in Dorchester by a man who writes for UKIP Weekly of that these figures have to be wrong. And I said they could be wrong, but it really is the IMF that have produced them. It's the proportion of our GDP we spend on public services for a series of different countries. So it's very similar to our tax take. You're often told that everywhere has become more unequal. We have to get taxes down because it's a race to the bottom to be most competitive. There is no alternative. If you want to win the global race, you have to do this. And you've got to accept growing inequality because that's part of what it is to get in the talent you need. And all this is fine as long as you've got absolutely no knowledge of geography. You've got no idea about what happens across. You know, Finland is not a destitute country where they're spending 57% of their GDP on public services. It went up in Finland, by the way, as their reaction to GDP going down with the crash. The way the Finns coped with having less money was to tax more and spend more on public services because they didn't want the schools to become worse, because 99% of Finns go to the state schools, which happen to produce the best results in the world. Better, actually, than Winchester and Eton in terms of what a child actually knows, or Rodin, just to go a bit more locally. Finland, France, Denmark, even Greece, Sweden, Germany, that's normal. Have a larger public sector. It's normal to fund your health service better. It's normal to fund your schools at a higher level. We fund our state schools incredibly lowly, particularly our sixth forms, which are not immune from the cuts. Sixth form funding is tiny. Why can we do this? Well, the cabinet aren't using those sixth forms. But also, we kind of believe in survival of the fittest. Why do they tax higher? They're still funding higher education. We don't anymore. It's £9,000 a year for you or your children. 3 years so far I've signed up to that. It's not really £9,000, it's £56,000. That's what you'll be paying back on average. But if you do a little bit better, you get a slightly better paid job, it's £100,000 that you'll be paying back. Alternatively, rather than entice a child to a higher purchase agreement they did not understand, which is what our university sector is now forced to do. You make the decision to go to university at 17 as a child. You couldn't sell a child a car like this, it would be illegal. Rather than do that and say, don't worry, you'll pay it off later, in the rest of Europe, they fund it collectively. They choose to do that. You can see where we're heading. Those are the cuts under the coalition and projected from George Osborne's own projections forward. Of where we're going to go. And if you want to complain about the new Labour spending, not fixing the roof when the sun was shining, 2002, 3, 4, 5, 6, you can see the very small, compared to other countries, increase in public spending. But it was very bad public spending because it funded a war which has been spectacularly unsuccessful, as you can see by watching the news any night of the week this year, years later. There's our income distribution. If you want to quickly work out where you are, if you're getting 440, you're in the middle. If you're in the bottom tenth, you'll be relying on benefits or a pension. And you can see if you're at the top. If any of you want to know if you're in the 1%, we'll reveal the 1% in the room later. For my students, I often get them to move around lecture theatres according to where they were born or by other ways. I've never been brave enough yet to get people to move around the lecture theatre according to income. And you can do it very quiet. I won't do it, don't worry. But the way you do it quietly is you talk to the person on your left and your right, just quietly tell them your income, and then you swap seats until we have all the better paid people here and the worse off people here. There may be a couple of people in the room, £160,000 a year to get in the 1%. Or if there's two of you, £200,000, only gets you in the bottom end of the 1%. But that's the level to get in. You may be looking at this and thinking, we have a transfer from the rich to the poor. This data came from John Hills. It only superficially looks like that. It's actually a transfer over the life course. People at the top tend to be in their 40s and 50s, largely men. The transfer is going to older people and younger people. And because the middle class tend to live for up to 10 years older in this country, the middle class get as much out of the welfare state as they pay in, because they get more out of it. More adult social care, more use of hospitals. Lung cancer's a quick death. Middle class stopped smoking in the 1950s. Actually costs more. I'm going to run out of time, so I'm not going to go on about these kind of graphics or these kind of graphics, and they're depressing. I'll let you look at that. This is the increased wealth of landlords in the country, as revealed again by a subversive organisation. in this case the Financial Times and the estate agent Savills, showing that landlords as a whole had gained 434 billion in the 10 years to 2014. This is cock-up. This was not deliberate. It was how the housing crisis played out. When the housing market crashed 2007, 2008, you couldn't get a mortgage. You still had to move cities if you had a new job, so you rented. The rents went up because too many people were trying to rent. With the increased money from the rents, landlords bought, because what else do you do with the money, and you know how to be a landlord. When landlords bought, the prices went up further. It happened in London in particular, it definitely will have happened in Brighton, it certainly happened in Oxford, where the only people buying now are landlords. As the prices go up, people can't buy, so they have to rent, so the rents can go up further. Because landlords have largely bought in the southeast of England, it's the escalation of the prices that's led to the increase in wealth that's occurred. At the moment in London, private tenants are going up by 1% a year. This is why we're heading towards a future of private renting for the majority of people. You cannot all fund your pensions from getting somebody else to rent from you. It doesn't work. And in fact, being a landlord with just one property doesn't work, as some of you will know. It's a bit like trying to run your own school when you've never done it before. It's actually quite hard to be a landlord. To be a landlord and make it work, you have to have a dozen or more properties, which is a minority of landlords, but the majority of landlords as far as tenants are concerned. And that's the group who've got all this money. It's a small number of landlords who've done very well. Most landlords in Britain have actually quite bad experiences of being a landlord. I was going to try and cheer you up. I think maybe one way of cheering you up is a study from ONS. For anybody who hasn't got a mortgage, a study from ONS in 2015, which said that outright homeowners and those with a mortgage and high pensions aren't happier. Now, this is good news. This is really good news. It's partly because we adapt. We adapt to our circumstances. I don't wake up every morning and go, thank the Lord I have a university superannuation scheme pension. You know, perhaps I should, but I don't. I don't thank the Lord that I have a mortgage bigger than the mortgage of every other dwelling that's ever existed since the dawn of history, right, which I might pay off at the age of 67. And of course I know I'm lucky, I mean a tragedy is where we've got to. But it doesn't make you happier on average, which suggests that we don't need to push people towards saying you need to get more and more stuff and you'll be okay, because it isn't actually true. Go to Kensington and Chelsea, go into Mayfair, look for the ecstatic billionaires who just can't stop smiling. They're just not there. The problem is that the most detailed accounts we get of the life of the super rich is in London's divorce courts. But then it's tragic lives, much more tragic than some of the poorest people in Britain, because they have things to argue over. There's the distribution. The data came from ONS. ONS didn't want the data released because they were underestimating it. This is the kind of worry about where we're heading. This is a board showing you the incomes of servants in Blenheim Palace, just north of where I live, 100 years ago. My worry is that we're heading back towards a world of servants. It's not just servants for the very rich or the billionaires. One reason people hated being servants, and we have it residually in our blood almost because it was the most common job for women 100 years ago, you couldn't have children if you were a servant because you lived in the basement or you lived in the attic. Servants was the only occupation in Britain that people wouldn't recommend to their children. Coal miners would tell their children to go down the mines, right? Blacksmiths would say be a blacksmith. No servant who managed to leave and have children would say go into service again. My worry about service coming back, if you define service as you do a job which means you can't start a family, then think about your young school teachers in Brighton who can rent a room on their wage but can never actually get a house, so can't have children themselves. And to what extent are they becoming servants for you and your children because they can't be the part of normal society? And I think we could begin to measure that. I'll let you look at the graph. This is data a couple of years old now. There were bad things happening in Britain. Last year, 30,000 more people died than the year before. Mortality rates are going up, absolutely. It's not mainly due to the flu. Superficially, it is the nursing crisis, thousands of waits of over 4 hours on trolleys in hospitals. It's the home visits more than halving, Meals on Wheels going. People are dying faster than they were dying before. It is depressing and it is unnecessary. What's most remarkable about this to me, and I've been emailing somebody today from the train in Scotland, is the lack of outcry. Scotland had a 9% increase in deaths in Scotland last year, the biggest increase outside of wartime, and nobody says anything. They're waiting for the mid-year population estimates to check there hasn't been a sudden influx of thousands of pensioners sneaking back in to die. And we don't think that's occurred. All four of our chief medical officers for the four countries of the UK, as far as I can see, none of them had mentioned that more people are dying than were dying the year before. We can't prove why. We've just got a kind of guess. It might have something to do with our politics and what's happened in the last few years, but we're forced to prove it. And we're very, very divided. And countries which are more unequal, in this case inequality in wealth, have lower life expectancy, which we're... This summer, life expectancy falling figures will be released. And they will try and do things like blame the fact that women smoked a little bit more in the 1970s. It doesn't have the immediate effects that we're seeing. The kind of things you can do, I've got about 5 minutes left, and then that's the question. This graph comes from Piketty and colleagues, and it's change over 40 years in top rate of taxation and change in the take of the 1%. As I said, our 1% is taking about 14-15% if you put a tax dodging estimate in. In the US, about 20%. Tax dodging is rife. I saw the official figures for our 1% showed a fall in their income to 12% of all income around about 2011-12, just after the 50p tax rate came in. What actually happened? I think something like it's between 10 and 20,000 new companies were started. These are companies with only one director and no employees. So you start a company yourself and you just pay yourselves dividends, but you keep the money in the... Tax dodging has become a normal way of behaviour in Britain for the upper echelons of this country. And this is tax dodging from very low rates of tax. In Germany, in Switzerland, in Denmark, in Spain, they've had the same high rates of tax for the last 40 years. They've hardly altered them. And has the 1% taken more? No, they haven't. For a very simple reason. If you're getting £150,000 a year, and you feel that it's not enough, and you want another £100,000 a year, but you're going to have to pay 60 or 70% of it in tax and then another 10% in health insurance, you're only going to get £20,000. So you don't bother going and asking for it. Whereas in our country, because the tax rates came down, people who are greedy and who think they've got some way of bargaining know they'll get most of the money, or at least half the money, if they ask for it. We have over 3,000 people earning over €1 million a year. It rose dramatically last year in the financial sector in London, but some will live here. We have over 3,000. The next highest in Europe is 197 in Germany. The total in the rest of the EU actually fell last year and is much, much smaller than our 3,000. Our 3,000 have nowhere to go because nobody else in Europe, including Switzerland, is paying anything like their salaries. So we're not paying them these salaries because they would otherwise leave, unless they're all going to go to New York and take the jobs of the American bankers who already have those jobs, which seems to be unlikely. High marginal taxes are there not to raise money, they're there to help the greedy not be greedy. And we just don't get that. That's the Institute of Fiscal Studies' prediction of what the cuts were going to happen in future. They all turned out to be true. In fact, it's slightly worse than that. Here's a student debt bubble in the US, which does have loans, but not quite as high as ours. But we can get our way out of this. We're going to have to get our way out of it already. We are planning that over half the loans will not be repaid. Right, the calculations for the student loan model assumes that half won't be repaid. The majority of young women in Britain go to university now, so in England. Over 50% go to university, less men. Having a university degree is not what having a university degree was when I went to university, which really was a ticket to odds on you were probably going to be okay back then. Half of all young women are going to university. We are either going to have the most incredible sexual revolution in this country in the next 10 years, and the salaries of those women are going to zoom up, and the salaries of men are going to have to drop way, way below them. And this is young women. Or we're going to work out that the student loan model isn't going to work, which is why we can't sell it to the private sector. And we're going to have to work out a way to get out of it. And that's going to be tricky. There are many options I can think of. We could talk about it later, but there are lots of things we've got to unravel. We've got to unravel our PFI, all the loans on the hospitals, which we can't repay. There's a lot of things that are going to have to be unraveled in the near future. And while we're thinking about it, the people who will suffer most are the people who are poorest, of which the majority, 2/3, are women with children. Here's the trend over time. Just highlighting, this is the country I grew up in. The country was called the United Kingdom then. It was the second most equal country in Europe, large country to Switzerland. I liked the 1970s. I had a valet chopper. but, you know, I remember I went to school, we went to the nearest school, school was fine, could have been a bit better. People in their 20s were having children, getting houses, everybody had a job. Terrible decade, wasn't it, 70s? Anyway, inequality goes up and up and up and up again. We try and copy America to become the most unequal country. Right? It's a natural experiment in what happens, and I'm afraid that's what we've done, which is why our cities are as divided as they are. But we've got used to it. We've got used to this. But we might get angry again. Last time we really got angry was 1929, after the last crash, when people produced cartoons like this cartoon, which was an anti-austerity cartoon. And the claim of that cartoon was that it wasn't fair that everybody took a step down because the man at the bottom would drown. And you can tell his class from his hat, four different kinds of hat. The equivalent cartoon today we had a go at has a woman at the bottom, and the difference, so you can't see it, is the man at the top has stepped up. So we should be angrier if we recognise that although most people's incomes and salaries and wages have gone down, their position has worsened. This isn't true for people at the top. People at the very top, the richest 1,000 families in Britain, doubled their wealth in this period. But they're not all happy, because if you look within the richest 1,000 families, 500 of them are in London, and the richest 10 families in London have a quarter of the wealth of the rest of the rich list. So you can be on the rich list and feel squeezed. You're not really rich, you've only got 120 million, not a billion. And you've got children to worry about. You've got to buy them all houses. And think about all the grandchildren's school fees. Doesn't take long at £36,000 a year to... But luckily you can invest your money and get a return. This kind of model of a let the rich be rich, it'll trickle down and make everything better for the rest, is the American model that we followed. It's a model that's resulted now, Matthew Desmond's new book called Evicted, it's well worth reading about life in American cities now, 1 in 17 black women being evicted a year from their homes, literally put out on the street with their belongings, 1 in 17 a year. Evictions in London doubled last year, but we're very embarrassed, so we don't do it quite as openly as in the US. We don't chuck everybody's possessions out. Not yet. But we do have food banks. Can you imagine me coming to this lecture theatre just 10 years ago? 2006. Imagine I came here to this lecture theatre in 2006 and said, the country will have thousands of food banks and people will be going begging for food and churches will be asking their congregations which particular tins of soup are good to get. You know, and don't give some other thing that isn't so useful. You wouldn't have believed me if 10 years ago I said this would have happened, but it's happened. And now when people say, and it could go, we could get rid of food banks in 5 years, they go, oh, that's unrealistic. But of course it could go. The tragedy until recently, just to get slightly more political, is that until recently it was impossible to get the Labour Party to pledge as one of their five pledges, no food banks after 5 years. Just as a promise, as an aspiration. You know, you can fail to hit your aspiration. But why not even make that as a pledge? Okay, if it's all so bad and it would all be so much better, why don't we make it better? Why do we tolerate this? Because some people think it's good. Some people think this level of inequality makes us very competitive, makes us very productive, because they don't look at the productivity figures. And they worry more about incivility and other kinds of behaviour which matter to them for some reason. They think change has gone too far, we need to restore the class, we need to restore respect. Human beings are a very different potential and ability. Their children have got their genes, so they need £36,000 a year spent on their education to realise their full genius potential that is in their sons. Maybe not, though their daughters could go to the one on the coast. And then they can be great leaders of us in the future. Whereas we, probably not me, because I'm now very posh, so I can join them. But most of you, and we won't tell you this because you won't understand, but most of you and your children never going to do what they can do. You're never going to make Britain great again. In fact, you might well be a burden. So let's make sure you work by sanctioning you over 1 million sanctions a year. Let's not waste too much money on your health service or your schools. Let's give you enough of a hope, lottery ticket, and keep you quiet while we get on with the serious business of making this country great again, like it once was. And all the time that this happens, this is a real estate agent sign in Oxford. I don't know, do you have these in Brighton yet? You've got somebody see one in Brighton, yeah. Too late. It's a global race. Talent moves around the world. Inequality is rising everywhere. You just have to go with it. It's the only option. Europe is the reason why our NHS is not well funded. Despite the fact that all these countries in the European Union seem to find their reason to fund better. If we leave Europe and we let the upper echelons rule again, we will trade brilliantly, we'll become the richest country in the world, which George Osborne's promised in 15 years. Just trust us. But because I don't think you're clever enough to understand me, I'll make sure we have a voting system that means that if only 30% of the electorate vote for me, I can still get a majority of seats in the House of Westminster. And please don't become too interested in politics, because it's much better if you don't vote, because it is quite hard to convince all of you that you really are all so stupid that you should just do what we want. Social scientists are supposed to be neutral, kind, understanding. Just to end, to try to balance it up, I don't think people who think that inequality is good are being disingenuous that much. I think they've really been brought up for a lot of their lives to believe this. They've been brought up to believe in competition. They've often been brought up to believe that they are particularly special. They might have gone to a university where they wear funny clothes during their examinations and are told when they turn up at the age of 18 that they are the creme de la creme, and the reason they're going to be sitting in tutorials with just one other student is because they're so terribly gifted, we need to give them that much attention. And people like me might be complicit in that myth being carried on. And how can you blame an 18 or 19 or 20 year old who's told that they're this special from believing that they're this special? And then they get a job, let's say at Carlton TV for £90,000 a year, which they might not have got on their own. But anyway, let's say they're paid £90,000 a year in their 20s. What do you do in your 20s? Remember, you're young. From my point of view, do you sit there going, I know I'm not worth £90,000, but hey, let's enjoy it? Or do you tell yourself, actually, I'm good at this job. I'm worth every penny. In fact, I'm underpaid. I'm not even in the 1%. I need to get more. And if you spend your life as well living in areas where people are better off, where in fact you're average compared to what they get, if you become the leader of a political party and your wife's better off than you, which was the case of all our leaders, Ed Miliband and Nick Clegg and David Cameron, then you don't think you've been being overpaid. And you think, well, if people just worked as hard as I've worked for my A-levels and my degree and in my job, they too could drag themselves up. And if you all just tried, or your children tried, or all your grandchildren tried hard enough, then you could all be in the 1%. And 100% of us could be in the 1%. And that's all you need to do. Just compete. I do think it's not a conspiracy of people on the right to keep people down. I think people are deeply misguided, but they're misguided because of the country we have become, which makes us more stupid about these things. Because as we've adapted to them, we've found ways of telling ourselves that this is normal. Mm-hmm. And it's okay to be the most unequal country in Europe, because somehow it makes us special at other things. But I think the time for that has come to an end now. The Panama Papers have revealed just how many people were laughing at the rest of us when we paid our taxes. How many people thought taxes is what the stupid people pay. But my money, I've worked so hard for it, that I'll be damned if I'm going to pay tax on that. After all, the tax is only going to pay for their schools and their hospitals and their buses, and I don't use any of those things. I just want somebody to collect my bins. And why can't the council do that every week? Thank you very much for listening to me.
Thank you very much, Danny. Festivals are curious things. They are meant to inspire you and excite you, which Danny's lecture did. They're meant to make you laugh. I'm not sure they're meant to make you feel too depressed, but there were moments in that lecture where you felt a little down. But I like the way as well, Danny made it clear that we all have a role to play in changing this. Anyway, we've now got 15 minutes, so please feel free to ask questions. Okay?
In such a lousy country, how come so many people...
That's Mike.
We'll get a mic to you.
Yeah. If it's all so terrible, how come so many people want to come and live there?
Yeah, it's a very good question. There's a nice correlation between inequality and migration. So the more unequal a rich country is, the higher the number of people coming. The US has far more people coming than we do, often from Mexico and other places. It's not because of Mexico, it's because unequal countries have lots of very lowly paid jobs at the bottom. There's lots of opportunities at the bottom to come in. If you look instead at more equal countries, of which the most equal is Japan, pretty low rate. There's quite some from Korea. Scandinavia fitted this brilliantly until the Scandinavians decided to be very nice and let in refugees from Africa and actually had a bigger increase. But migration is higher to more unequal countries because there are more opportunities, not just at the bottom, but also at the top. If you look at the Sunday Times wish list, the Queen's now down at number 80 or something. Although it's interesting to ask, you know, you'd have to get back very far in her family to find that they weren't here for that long, at least her husband. Most of the people above her are immigrants. So rich immigrants come in, poor immigrants come in, you get a greater rate of immigration and also emigration. A huge number of people have left this country. Not quite as many as come in, so we were about net, but many, many hundreds of thousands, over a million, have gone to Spain and Crete and Malta and so on. So that they, our old, have left. Our old are much more likely to leave. If this was a wonderful country, they might stay. And it's not just the sun that they've gone through. Although if we leave Europe, unless they can afford private health care, they're coming back. If we let them.
Hello, Danny. Does the fairer city need a university in general? in particular, does it need a university if it's a cold spot in terms of participation in one of the richest regions in Europe?
Yeah.
And if it does need a university, what kind of university does it need?
Yeah.
In terms of private and public sector, thanks.
Okay, so it's interesting having working in university as well. My view is that cities should have a university, preferably one. It just would make more sense. I know we like competition in this country. If you look across Europe, you'll see that most cities have a university, tend to have one. Look in Scotland as well. In fact, it's anywhere but England. You have a university, and your local children go to that university. And you can click on the website of any of these universities, and they won't say how wonderful they are. They'll just say, we're the university. In fact, they produce students who are so wonderful that the majority of our postdocs who actually come to my university have been educated in European universities, because they can do things like program computers and other things from their education. If you click on one of our universities, you'll find 30 that claim to be in the top 10. normal, and they have to sell themselves, because you know we now have to market much more. There are a series of cold spots. Lincoln was one, and it got to university, where children are unlikely to go to university if they grow up there. Tragically, I live in one. It's an area underserved by universities. It's called Oxford. There isn't a local university for children in Oxford. Both Oxford Brookes and Oxford University take hardly any children. Just one in five at Oxford Brookes came from Oxfordshire. Can you imagine that? From outside the city, not from the city of Oxford. So it's a particular shame for the city that I'm from. But what is normal is that your university is local and that a majority of people would go to your local university. This is the case in the States, where you go in-state and you get lower fees. So if you're trying to think, how do we get out of this problem of £9,000? For a start, you make it only £4,000 if you're local. And then I would make it only £3,500 if you wait till you're 19. Because it's a hell of a mistake to make now going to university. Wait till you're 20, £3,000. Wait till you're 21. Actually saves the government money in the short term. And all governments are worried about financially is the short term. Not good for the universities, but we've got a increase coming. It happened first to our primary schools. You remember not enough places in primary schools? Now it's coming through to secondary, the bulge is coming through. The bulge is going to come through and hit universities, so we could use the bulge and in effect bribe people to delay going to make it more equal. But we've got to get out of this situation of marketing to children what are lies. Demonstrable lies that your salary will be as high in terms of difference to non-graduates as happened for your parents' and grandparents' generation. We have to lie as a sector, because if you don't lie in a university where you can't be sure of getting the students, you won't get the students, and then you have to sack members of staff. But we've got to get away from this, and we've got to get back towards the normal model of going to your local university. Or you could even look, so I'll keep all the other question answers short, sorry. But you could look at Texas, which is hardly a radical state in the United States. In Texas, they decided recently one in 10 of all children from all schools should go to university. The 10% who do best from any school go. They've had cutbacks, so they've cut it back to 8%, I learned last week. Can you imagine us deciding that the tenth of children from any school that do best should just get a place in local university? It would be a bit of a shock to my colleagues if we were to offer places at my university to the children who do better than 9 out of 10 kids in the local school. We can't. What fascinates us is what's like. We can't even imagine doing things that other places are currently doing, even like Texas.
Question at the back there, yes.
Hi. Given that last year we re-elected a Conservative government, and given that the currently socialist leader of the Labour Party is hated by the majority of his colleagues in Parliament, I wondered if you could give us some reasons to feel hopeful. That things might actually change for the better in the foreseeable future.
Yeah, well, when it's really bad, when you are the most unequal country in Europe, there's only one way you can go. I mean, it's unlikely, events just chance among us. We're unlikely to actually carry on being in this position. Something bad will happen, but that isn't what we should hope for. A hopeful thing I will go for, and you can guess my politics already, but I'm not actually a member of any party. I didn't even pay £3 to vote in that election. The fact that election occurred is quite incredible. The fact that millions of people joined a party, the fact that the Labour Party, through its membership, moved towards becoming a normal European Labour Party, no more radical than that. All our parties have moved to the right. Blair did things that Margaret Thatcher would never have dared to have done. Yeah. All parties in other countries are to the left. Angela Merkel is described as a right-wing politician here. None of our politicians would let in a million people from Syria or have trade unionists on the boards of companies that she has. I'd be hopeful that man was elected, particularly given that of all of them who could have been from that group, he was the nicest, the one who really didn't want it, particularly as his wife, new wife. Yeah, poor thing. She never saw that coming. I'd be hopeful that he's still there, and John McDonnell's still there, and the coup hasn't happened. I'd be hopeful at watching the language of the MPs change. I don't think it's a majority in the Labour Party, parliamentary party, who hate him. I would say it would be about a quarter now, and I've watched it move. I've watched former Blairites who never really believed much in Blairism, but they knew what to say to get in the cabinet. I've watched them talk about equality with a fervour I've never seen them talk about before. And I don't think they are fooling us. I think, this is the kind of way that things are moving. Other reasons to be optimistic? They have elected the MP with the lowest expenses of all 650 as leader of the Labour Party. The one you've all heard about is Chris Mullen, because Chris only claimed for a £10, for a black and white TV licence. Chris is nice, but why did he bother claiming for that? You all pay your TV licences, whereas Jeremy Corbyn didn't even claim for his TV licence. More importantly, for reasons for practical optimism and winning politics, if you look at the Scottish referendum, what happened then was a good 30% of people who don't normally vote, voted. 40% of the electorate in this country didn't vote in 2015. So your real votes are amongst those who don't vote, not amongst switching between Labour and the Conservative. And if you're going to get people who don't normally vote to vote, you've got to present them with something worth voting for, which is different to the past. So there's a possibility there. You also need to get people to register to vote. I think we've got 7 million people not registered to vote. But another reason, I can give you more, but I promise short answers. Another reason for optimism is that supposing you had a right-wing leader of the Labour Party at the moment, all you get with a right-wing leader of the Labour Party is the party wins an election every kind of 15 years, normally gets in for 5 years, Blair was an oddity, and tinkers with things slightly, puts some double glazing in the council houses but doesn't talk about it, which is what the last government did, but doesn't change the general direction. And then you get the Conservatives back for another 10 or 15. What the Tories really, really don't want is this particular Labour Party getting power because of what it might do. It takes one day to change the law on short-hold tenancies and give people tenants' rights. One day in Parliament. There's an enormous number of things to do, but winning an election is very difficult and involves geography. And one of the things you need to do is you need to talk to the people who you've got most in common with, which in this case is the Greens, and you need to stop fighting each other. There are 10 seats in the country that the Greens could target. There are 5 of those seats that they could win, and they could walk out of the other 600 odd, and you'd have 5 Caroline Lucases. And that's just one of many things that need to happen. It happened in the city of Chester in May 2015. The Greens didn't stand very quietly, didn't tell anybody, so if you keep it quiet here, because you're not allowed to do that, they didn't stand. Labour won it by about 95 votes. There's lots of things you need to do. I'm trying to give you some hope, but part of the reason for hope is the alternative to a more traditionally electable Labour Party with an Andy Burnham figure or even a Sadiq Khan figure, is business as usual. Do you have a bit of hope? Four mayors winning and a Muslim winning in London. I don't think Sadiq would have won London without the Jeremy Corbyn effect. I don't think the Oldham by-election would have gone the way it did without the Jeremy Corbyn effect. I think nobody has actually analysed the polls and the movement in votes by stepping back and pretending there isn't a man with a beard from Islington there. Let's just look at the numbers. And the numbers don't look as bad as the stories.
Question here. Pass the microphone. There's someone in the middle here.
Okay, just quick. Could you give, say, let's say you were able to, Corbyn got in and you were able to advise him, what would be your top five policies to reduce inequality? You don't have to speak at length about each one.
No, just top five.
To give you that option, but if you were to have five,
okay.
Which one would be the most effective?
Introduce proportional representation so you can never get to government like this again. And live with the UKIP MPs you will get. Change tenancy laws so that private rented tenants have rights and their rent cannot be put up for the 5 years where they're in, which immediately brings the housing market down. Abolish Trident to save the money and because it's just dangerous. And most countries in Europe manage not to have a weapon of mass destruction that hopefully their leaders never intend to use. That's three so far. Bring in wealth taxes as an emergency tax because we're going to need to raise money somehow to do things. And the fairest way is to raise it on the wealth, particularly land wealth, which you cannot hide. Then raise the top rate of income tax, not to raise money, but to help Jeremy Clarkson not take on that extra TV deal he might be thinking of doing, because he's getting old and he needs to just work more if he really wants to work and not for the money. I'll stop there.
Thanks. The gentleman stole my question, but the second part of the question was, in what way, as part of the Fairness Commission, have you been able to influence some of the policies?
Well, in a way, the London Fairness Commission, I suppose, was set up, and it was much more neutral than this. I should say I was one of the more left-field candidates on it. We had a banker from Barclays on it. Who I got on with well after 12 months of meeting every month, which is interesting. One of the most interesting things about the Commission was you can get on with people of very different views from you if you spend enough time talking to each other. I think the reason the Fairness Commission was funded by two charities in London was to try to raise the issues of fairness and inequality in London. The decision was made a year and a half ago. In fact, having the son of a billionaire versus a bus driver was actually enough to raise the issues without a Fairness Commission. We did produce a long report. I think it was quite a good report. It's a very measured report about what affluent West London thinks is fair, and that's much fairer than what we currently have. So if that isn't reasonable, what is reasonable? The tragedy of the Fairness Commission was that Sarah Sands of the Evening Standard promised to give us a double page spread, and on the day of publication we got that. Always beware of certain people in the media, because there are a group of people who do not really want fairness to be discussed, who do not want inequality to be described as something bad, who believe that the more billionaires we get in, the better for our country because we've won, and the higher the house prices go, the more successful that shows we have been. And if you can't hack it, you should leave. And I think I underestimated the strength of feeling amongst that small group of people. Okay, I've tried really hard. The only thing I've really learned as I got older and older and older is not to predict, because I've made so many bad predictions, particularly on the housing market. Partly because the housing market is unpredictable. It's like an earthquake, It's like trying to predict earthquakes if you're a physical geographer. We know where they happen. We know that if it's a long time since Los Angeles has had one, it'll be big next time. And same how, and so predictions are, I'm not just saying it because people always say it. I've learned. But then I'll give you my prediction, but I think my prediction is so dangerous that I'm voting to stay in. I think we will become much more equal. The reason I think we'll become more equal if we voted to leave, I think we'd have a second referendum put on us and we'd have to vote to leave in that as well. That's normal. We've just always behaved ourselves. In every referendum we've been given, which is only about four, we've always voted the way we're supposed to. Whenever people don't vote the right way in a referendum, the country makes them vote again. So you'll probably get another referendum, but supposing you vote to leave in that, or even before then, what's the effect on the housing market of stopping people coming into a country? What's the effect on those people in the country of listening to a country describe how much it doesn't like them being here? This is all the teachers from the mainland, all the doctors and the nurses from the mainland, that we're going to spend an increasingly bitter few weeks talking about how horrible it is that they're all here. You know, people are going to leave, other people won't come. If we leave, of course, they won't be allowed to come unless they earn the amount of money we say is enough for them to come. So our housing market will crash, which might not be a bad thing for equality. The pound, we haven't had a run on the pound for a long time. It's about time we had a run on the pound. People cause runs on the pound by playing with it, like Soros did. When you get a run on the pound, you have to defend the pound by rising interest rates. If you rise interest rates, anybody took out a mortgage last year? Think about interest rates going up to defend the pound falling. Then the pensioners start trying to come back from Spain. The clever ones come back quicker because the price of bungalows is going to go up. And there's a lot of them. In fact, it's one of the biggest areas of immigration in Europe is our immigrants, who of course aren't immigrants, they're expats, because we don't have immigrants. They come back to a health service that already cannot cope, in which 30,000 people more died last year, which is going to lose its doctors and nurses from the mainland. So at what point do we do what we did in 1965 and say, just because you've got a British passport doesn't mean you can come back? And in my city, BMW have already said they'll move the car plant to Munich. The biggest income of my university is European funding. It's a quarter of our income comes from Brussels. It'll bring house prices down in Oxford. It'll bring salaries down. It'll make us more equal, but in that kind of way that might not make us happier. But it could, but I don't think it's worth the risk. You know, we've got a very, very strange class system. We have things that are odd in this country. I think it could end all of that in 15 years. And then in 15 years, we'd go back on our knees and beg to rejoin and go back at, I don't know, £3 to the euro, £4 to the euro. And if you think that's ridiculous, when I first went to France as a 15-year-old, my first ever trip abroad with school, I can remember getting 10 francs to the pound. Yeah? And then if you're old enough, and then three, and now it's parity. We're becoming a normal country. We were the richest country on the planet 100 years ago. Not because we were brilliantly industrious and we were brilliant at producing things and we were inventive. We just owned half the planet. And as the bits we owned got their freedom and we stopped being able to make as much money out of them as we used to do, we became relatively poorer. But we've never accepted that story, which is why you hear the Making Britain Great Again by forming trade agreements with our Commonwealth partners. Yeah. We're not going to recreate the British Empire again. So it's a long answer. I don't think it's worth the risk. I go for Remain because Europe is a rich boys club, but we're worse, and it actually protects us from things that our government would do to us otherwise.
Yeah, hi Dan. I just wanted to get back to what you were saying very early in your talk about income inequality and whether you feel perhaps there are some more grounds for optimism than some other parts of your speech were suggesting. I'm thinking particularly of the fact that the Conservative administration is beginning to accept that there are significantly social damaging issues as regards low income. Yeah. There is this thing called the living wage introduced by Tory
Chancellor, probably a greater economic significance than was the wage, minimum wage introduced by the Labour predecessors, or pre-predecessors. Mm. So I wonder if there are not perhaps some grounds for optimism as regards policy consensus.
No, you're right, there are. I should have done more of them. The living wage, I mean, not the same as the other living wage, the official one, but it's still remarkable. I mean, it's almost Stalinist. It's I think a quarter of people in work will be being paid a wage set by the Chancellor. That would have been unbelievable in the past. There is a growing recognition as a problem. If you look at the take of the top 1% around the world, in the last 3 or 4 years, you can see it dropping in many countries. If you look at the 10-10 ratio of inequality across Europe, it's dropping in more countries than it's going up. So we may be passing a peak of global inequality, apart from the richest 65 people on the planet. You know, but apart from them, at these extremes, there is a turn. Worldwide, Branko Milanovic, the World Bank banker, has shown that there's growing equality in the world. The average middle of the world is doing much better. People in the top 10% are actually not doing better, apart from that top 1%. And there's a story came out yesterday, which was not hailed as a good news story, but I thought was a brilliant news story, that the chairman of Fortune 500 companies in the US, people running the richest 500 companies in the US, are now getting, I think it's 320 times the average worker's wage a year. Last year it was 370. 370 to 320 in 1 year is incredible. Their average income has dropped from $13 million a year to something like 12, while the average income of a worker has gone up by $900. Now, this makes me incredibly happy because of the weird person I am. You know, you might be saying, but this is just terrible. They're being paid $12 million and somebody else has only had this. But it's an incredible reduction in inequality in the States in 1 year that's occurring. And what may be occurring is what a man called Oswald Fulkes, who was a banker, noticed occurring in the 1930s. And he was talking about what his friend Keynes was doing. And he said it wasn't about a wonderful economic model of equilibrium and all the assets going on in the 30s. He said, what's happening in Britain in the 1930s? Was a change in the moral sentiment. The understanding of what was right and correct and fair was changing in the 30s. From the jazz age being seen as okay and the rich chastening their way away and having lots of servants, through to an inspector calls and what responsibilities you have for other people becoming normal. And half of that equality was gained before 1939. And half of the attitude was changed with the general strike and the crash and the mass unemployment before 1939. We make a terrible mistake of thinking it took the Second World War to make our society a solidarity society, but we were on the way, halfway there beforehand. And it's when people are no longer impressed by other people becoming rich, that's the beginnings of it. And then you have to go on and on. Where you get to eventually, just to give you an idea of how far we are away from this, is the situation in Norway, which is probably the most equal country in Europe. And I made the mistake a few years ago in Oslo of talking to a group like you and beginning my talk by saying, congratulations on having the lowest rate of child poverty in the world. And I got boos and hisses, and people shouted, it's too high, what do you mean? And I said, but it's the lowest rate in the world. And they were angry because it was too high. We're a long way away from that. But we're not as bad as America, where recently you'll be told that that's simply a decision for their parents and whether they've worked hard enough. And if your parents don't try hard enough, you don't deserve to be well off. We're not there yet. I think we're getting better. But you have to push it. It doesn't happen naturally. And it's a fight. And it's a fight that's underneath the surface, because people don't tell you that they think that only a few of you have it in you. And most of you aren't up to much, and we'd be wasting our money supporting most of you.
We got one more question. One question there, and then probably the last one of the day. Just down here.
Hi. I was wondering what you think about the future of the welfare state going forward. We've seen it sort of demonised in the last since 2010. figure out ideas such as the universal basic income, the future of the welfare state, essentially.
Yeah. It is interesting. The welfare state is supposed to be a welfare for all of us. That's the idea we've lost. So I suspect that most of the middle class members of this audience will not know what Job Seekers Allowance is, because you will never think you'll rely on it. And it's stopped being a welfare state. I think it does have a future, but the future needs to be very different. When we envisaged a welfare state in the 20s and 30s, we were envisioning something very different from the past. When we got it, we then wanted to improve it. So although we got free education, we wanted to improve that education so it wasn't divided at 11 and so on. For the last 40 years, we've been defending it. So it's a bit like sitting in the 1950s and defending the 1930s. You know, defend comprehensive education, defend council housing, defend the top-down Stalinist NHS. One problem that the welfare state has had is it hasn't had people coming up with ideas, and I don't have them, saying, what kind of housing do we want to have in future? And what kind of control do we want to have over our social housing? Do we want to rely on a council or some patricians in a housing association? Or could we do it ourselves in a group of maybe 300 or 400? Similarly with schools. Academies are a very bad idea, unless you like the idea of having 8 trustees who don't send their children to your school in charge of it. Half of whom, as far as I can see, have started those little companies to avoid taxation, because they have to declare their company directorships. But that doesn't mean that comprehensive education in the 1970s and 80s was the peak of achievement. So we should have a campaign for something different in our schools, and we've lost that. Because I'm a geographer, because of what I've been saying, you can go on holiday and look. Take your pick. Go and look at what they do in Denmark with schools. Go and look at what they do in the Netherlands with housing. Go and look at the healthcare system in Switzerland, where they worry it's costing them too much, admittedly, because they don't know how lucky they are. Just go across the mainland of Europe and see the different options which are already in place for a better welfare state in future. I wish we could be more proactive than that. I wish we had Norway's problem. You know, Norway's problem is, what on earth do you do now? Because you can't look to somebody else who's done it, because nobody has got child poverty down this low. So if you're going to get it lower, you're going to have to do it by yourselves. We can get child poverty lower much, much more easily than that. Initially, it's simply a case of making sure that families with poor children have a bit more money. It really isn't rocket science to do it.
Okay. I'm sorry to all the people who've had their hands up. We can't get to all the questions, but the last question over there with the microphone.
Yeah, sorry to take another question. Danny, it's just about an article that I read and shared with some of my former colleagues about teaching, when you described it as like a colonisation process. The colleagues that I shared that with sort of summed up that really summed up what feels like sort of happening within the education system. You've got sort of government ministers who've gone to different schools, who send their children to different schools, put in a very foreign sort of outlook upon the teaching profession. It just doesn't work with the children. How would you sort of advise the teachers to try and navigate that terrain of almost being under colonisation, as it were?
Yeah, this is partly what's happening in our schools. Our schools being forced to be academies. Academies are then autonomous, so they can choose their own selection criteria at 16. So if you're an academy in the posh part of town, you don't take children who don't get 4 Bs and 4 Cs in the case of Oxford. So in Oxford, the children from the council estates are being excluded from the local school and pushed towards the poor part of town with more council estates, those kind of things going on. The people who run the state schools now, odds on, are sending their children to private schools. They're running the state schools as an act of charity to help the lower orders and their schools. You get rid of parent governors because you are not to be trusted as a governor, because you don't have it in it to lead, and you need business people leading the schools. I'm making it sound bad. If I could get better at this, I would give a sincere talk from a right-wing point of view about why they're doing this, because they do believe. But it's going to fail. It's already failing because the degree of corruption in academies is so high. The cost is higher. It actually costs far more to make every school self-governing than to have some sharing of resources and child psychologists and so on. And we're not becoming richer as a country. All these things, the student loans, the school academies, privatisation of the NHS, it all costs much more than what we had before, and we are becoming poorer. You know, so if you want a reason for optimism, this is going to end unless George Osborne gets what he wants and we suddenly become the most productive country on the planet and we can afford to pay all the debts back. That's not going to happen. What teachers need to do is to plan what to do when it starts to unravel. And it isn't just going back to the 70s. I've suggested ridiculously for schools, why not have a model of governance for schools where the majority of people, of your governors, are actually teachers, and the teachers can overrule the head teacher and they govern the school, but you have a few other people, you have some parents, you have some students, and that's your kind of hippie governing body. You know, what a ridiculous model, the idea that you have the teachers can actually govern themselves. I took the model from my college in Oxford, because that is what an Oxford college governing body is. Right? We have 30 odd colleges, and each college is governed and owned by the people who teach in the college, who then pass it on to the next teachers. It's not wonderful, it's not perfect, but it's certainly not particularly left wing. But it also is very robust. And it's very interesting, the first time I've worked in my life anywhere where I've watched senior management not being able to bully people because they don't have the power. I don't think you get superheads. I think you get good schools with lots of good teachers and the head who doesn't muck things up and helps. I do think you get really bad leaders who can really completely destroy something. I don't happen to believe in super able individuals ever. And models that rely on a few super able individuals, I think, are very, very dangerous. You need models that take everybody's talent and have a way of dealing with somebody when they become a liability, particularly if that person happens to be the highest paid person in your organisation. It's a different model. We need lots of people to come up with different models. Somebody wrote a paper in the 1920s, an obscure paper called The Health Centre, about this strange idea of having a health centre where doctors might work together to make their job easier. That's how we got health centres. Everything we have ever got began life as an idea roughly 20 to 30 years before it existed that somebody said was completely nuts. Right? And we need lots of people having those ideas now, because we're going to need those ideas in the near future, because we are not going to become the richest country on the planet again because of our wonderful bankers and how well respected they are. That is not on the agenda. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Danny, and just like to invite everybody to have a drink with us outside, but also just to reflect on one thing. Danny said people don't want you to talk and debate fairness. Well, I hope you recognise that here at the University of Brighton, we do want to debate and discuss fairness, and thank you to you all for coming along and taking part in that debate and asking Danny questions. But I should just end again by thanking Danny, not only did he challenge us, but as part of the Fringe Festival, he entertained us and also inspired us. So just join me in one more round of applause.